Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez from the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Conference and Marketplace at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Indigenous people have long been stewards of the land, using indigenous knowledge handed down from generation to generation to care for the land and water and the human life, and it's still used today. Western ways of thinking have changed the environment and how issues are addressed, but many tribes across the country incorporate both their traditional knowledge and Western science to tackle tough concerns, including climate change and even health care. And I have two great guests joining me this morning. Please welcome Mita DeWitt and Yari Walker. Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Mita, please introduce yourself to our audience.
I am Tlingit. I'm on Dena'ina lands in Anchorage, Alaska. And my family comes from Wrangell in southeast Alaska. We are Tlingit.
Well, thanks so much. And same, Yari, please introduce yourself.
I like to go by my Yupik name, which is Yari. I don't often use my colonial name. But my clan is Aymaramka, and I'm a guest here on the Dena'ina lands. And I'm very thankful that they allow us to live here on their lands.
Well, thank you both for the introduction. And Yari, why don't you go ahead and kick us off and tell us why traditional knowledge is so important?
Traditional knowledge is very important. When I think about how I was raised by my traditional grandparents on my paternal side, from day one, they instilled the values in me and taught me how to be. So one of the things that's really important to our people, what they taught me was about Nikuhluan or Yuwumashuk, which translates into the ways of the human being. It teaches you how to discipline yourself, how to govern your people. It teaches you how to have relationships with people, with animals, earth, nature, our ancestors and creator. And when you practice this way of life, it allows you to live a very healthy life with your emotional, your physical, your spiritual, and your mental being. So we focus on the entire being instead of like how in the Western culture, they only focus on the mental and the physical. Whereas with these practices, they allow us to practice on the entire being.
And Mita, anything to add to that?
Well, I agree 100%. Our traditional culture was based on best practices. It was meant to be proactive instead of reactive. And it's also meant to be adaptive to the situations. You know, I was just talking to the kids yesterday and saying how our elders, they're supposed to remember, and we're supposed to be learning too, our relationships, our genealogy 12 generations back. And within that, even further back, we go into story or into the story realm to remember our history. And it teaches us how to be in right relationship, how to be good relatives, what are the protocols for living well, because our cultures are structured to create the highest and best outcomes for the people, the community, and for nature.
And there are a lot of people who are here at the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Gathering, and we got a chance, producer Emily Schwing and I are talking to attendees, and a lot of the stuff that you both are talking about are important to tribes, not only here in Alaska, but tribes across the country. And the National Congress of American Indians, tribal leaders from all over the lower 48, and then tribal leaders from here in Alaska are here talking about a lot of top concerns, including the climate and health and well-being, not only of the climate, but their people as well and their communities, exactly what you're talking about. So we got a chance to speak with a tribal leader from New Mexico. Gil V. Hill is a Pueblo leader. And he says, looking back at the influence of his tribe's creation stories and relying on traditions is woven in through their people, through time, through history. So let's hear what he has to say.
My name is Gil V. Hill, and I'm from New Mexico, Tisuki Pueblo to be specific. I'm the executive director of the A Northern Indian Peoples Council. but I'm also a former governor of my Pueblo, Tizuque. Well, our concern, of course, is everything. What needs to be done? That's a magic question. And I think we've come too far down the road, not respecting Mother Earth, but we're in a place now that it's hard to go back, and we're trying to make changes to do that. As a Pueblo man, we believe in our creation story. And in fact, we're on a journey to decolonizing ourselves. And we've been on that journey to talking about our traditional cultural ways. We were given the gifts to help Mother Earth to sustain her, because she's going to sustain us by providing all the things that's necessary for us to live our life by. The vegetation, the food, the animals, the environment, all these things. So our prayers, our songs were all aligned according to that. When the Spanish in our area came and disrupted that whole process, that was the beginning of our demise. And because now they impose Catholicism on us, they impose other things, other practices, other religions, other ways of life, denied us our ways. Now we've come 300-400 years down the road. Try to go back. It's a challenge because, again, not just the people themselves, a lot of our young people don't speak the language anymore. So to make changes at that level, that's the challenge right now, just to educate them or educate people of all the things that are happening, especially the Congress. And that's why this meeting is occurring, I think. But all the issues that we are confronted with just didn't happen overnight. It took a long time. Domestic violence, alcohol and drug abuse, and in child welfare. We have all these federal laws now to protect our people, but the Congress, the same people that put it together, are challenging us today. And so it's hard to kind of try to be a positive to make change in those areas because of the challenges that are put in front of us.
And that was Gil Vigil, a Pueblo leader who's here at the National Congress of American Indians mid-year gathering taking place in Anchorage. And Yari, there were a lot of things that stuck out to me listening to this Pueblo man, a Pueblo leader from New Mexico, and echoing a lot of what we're already talking about right here this morning. And one thing was the decolonizing and tribes going back. I've heard terms like indigenize, but definitely going back and addressing these issues through traditional knowledge.
Well, I received my bachelor's degree in counseling psychology at Alaska Pacific University. My plans are to receive my master's in counseling psychology eventually. Right now I'm studying rural development at UAF for my master's. I am very interested in taking my Western degree and integrating our traditional ways into my future practice. Instead of practicing a traditional Western counseling session in an office space, what I want to do with that is I want to meet people where they're at. I don't want to per se do an assessment with people, asking them questions and writing on a piece of paper. That's not what I want to do. Because when I went through Western counseling, it was very intimidating for me. I felt like I was being interrogated. It just made me feel very uncomfortable watching somebody write about me in front of me. I did not like that. My plan is to practice Yugumashlakanikuhluan in my future work. I'm very interested in opening a Qazgik in the community, a functional Qazgik, which is a men's house, but also a community house where we could come together to sing, dance, storytell, and the young boys learn how to make hunting tools as well as the girls. And this is where the girls are also going to learn how to process traditional foods and how to skin sew and learn about Nkuhluan and Yugumatlak, because it will allow our community to be healthier, to make better choices, to make better decisions, how to have a relationship with nature. For instance, last summer when I was driving into work, when the cottonwood trees come, all these cotton things like flying around, I had my window rolled down. And they started to fly into my car. And in my mind, I started to complain. But then I remember what my grandfather taught me. He said, never complain about nature because it is far greater than you. So I pulled my car over and I began to talk to these things flying around my car out loud. And I said, please forgive me for complaining. Please forgive me for complaining. Thank you for your existence. Thank you for the trees. Thank you for the leaves. Thank you for providing oxygen for us. So please forgive me for complaining.
And Mita, your thoughts?
In response to Gil, I agree. You know, it's like the thing is, indigenous principles are found all over Turtle Island. There's going to be similarities, whether, you know, Alaska has over 227 registered tribes, and there are similarities, even though we're very different people. And going back to that wisdom of our elders is integral in us moving forward, because we have to reclaim who we are as a people, our spirit. You know, one of our teachers, Wilson Justin, talks about how climate change started at contact, because that's when our relationship with the environment went out of balance. That's when it was the over-harvesting and the mistreatment of the animals and each other started to occur in a greater experience in our state. So by us decolonizing, that's only halfway, right? Then we have to go and indigenize, and especially here in Alaska, because our communities, we only have one place that's considered a reservation, right? That's Metlakatla, and they like to refer to it as a reserve. But all of our communities are integrated up here. Anchorage has anywhere from 8% of the population. Some communities have over 80% indigenous population. And so I talk about, like, if you're going to clean a bucket of water, right, and you're only going to clean 20%, then the other 80% is going to continue to bring that particulate in. So if you're going to clean a bucket of water, you have to think about the whole bucket and clean all of it. And that's part of, you know, people coming to this space with the colonization, they bring that pain with them because they had experienced it as well. And so moving forward, our values are based on community and like I said earlier, right relationship. And so we have to think about this in a greater context, because we can't just change climate change for ourselves, right? We have to do it for all of us as a group moving forward.
And what is the importance of meetings like this, where there's a bunch of different tribes from across the country coming together and talking and sharing? Like you said, that there are similarities between, you know, the knowledge and the beliefs, but also just working together and sharing from different tribes. Yari?
I feel like it's very important for all the different tribes to stay connected and build a relationship with one another and get to know each other, because when we do that, when we learn about each other and understand about each other, we can also learn from each other and work together. And when we work together in unity, it just makes it more powerful. We could have more positive outcomes.
And there are people from a lot of different, there's young people here as well, and there are people who are talking about these issues and listening to each other, from youngest to oldest that are here. And one of the things that is on the agenda, there are nearly half of the more than 570 federally recognized tribes in the United States are located here in Alaska. So a lot of the agenda and discussions and activities are centered around a lot of those, including climate change. There was a task force yesterday where tribal leaders were talking about climate change. The youth are talking about it. And there's also people from all over the country who are here. And our producer, Emily Schwing, got to talk to some hunters and just some of the stuff they're seeing in the environment when they're out there. So let's go to that clip.
I'm Thomas Solano from Berwick Mission. Pretty much our elders taught us, you know, to watch our weather and our ice.
I am Elmer Sitot III. I am from Berwick Mission, which is 80 miles northwest of Nome. So we just got done doing a spring harvest, catching bearded seals and walrus. So that was a successful year for us. Kind of seems like the past couple years we've been having these bad, strong north winds, and our ice just takes off pretty fast.
The climate change, you know, it take a big impact on us, because guys have to hunt earlier, and, you know, basically we depend on the ice for spring harvest, you know, for walrus and bearded seals.
Respect the land and the animals we're hunting. Make sure you just get enough for
yourself and your family. Don't overhunt.
Always respect the land and the animals. You know, don't take more of what you need. That if you do, you know, give it out to the families that don't have any hunters. So we always try to share what we get, you know.
And those were some hunters here that were taking part in the National Congress of American Indians mid-year gathering, and they were talking about some of the things they're seeing in the environment and the animals. Mita, first, go ahead and just, you know, we're all shaking our heads listening to this.
Well, it's good to hear that the hunters are here and part of this conference because traditionally, you know, they have a very special role in providing for the community and making sure, like they said, you know, families don't have food, that they're there. But hearing that on the land report is so necessary because it's firsthand. There's years, decades of, you know, watching the environment and watching it change. And there's so much science that's woven into that process because, you know, like hunting and doing things in a good way means that you prepare year round and you have to watch for the weather and the animals and the changes year round, and you're always in preparation. So living in that way, being close to the land, that information, those signs are much more prevalent. They're more observable than for people who may not be able to get out on the land. So I think that as a voice to be heard, they're definitely primary and should be, you know, up there and celebrated like our community leaders are across Turtle Island.
And I think that definitely is important to hear from people in the community because there's a lot of layers when it comes to addressing issues tribal communities across the country are facing. And definitely there's, you know, the community leaders, there's grassroots groups, all the way up to tribal leaders who are here working with federal leaders. There's members of Congress who are speaking here. There's White House people. There's a lot of different moving parts when it comes to addressing this, but definitely having that community voice. Yari?
I think about what worries me is because we rely heavily on the walrus. They call my village the walrus capital of the world because we harvest about 360 walruses per year. And hearing the stories from my sons who are hunters and by my uncles and other men in the community, they have to travel further out to harvest walrus. And it worries me because we rely on it for sustainability and survival. And when it comes to bowhead whale hunting, we rely on it to travel on it. And when the snow and ice is melting sooner and at a faster rate, it cuts our whale hunting season shorter. So it's very important that we try to harvest at least one or two whales per year and all the walruses we can get. Because when my daughter went home last year to live with my sister for a while, she was able to experience food shortage. And I was telling my sister that I'm actually glad she's experiencing that because she gets to share that story, the importance of harvesting walrus and whales and seals and reindeer. And she experienced the firsthand of food shortage. So that's what came to my mind.
And I also, you know, just listening to them talking about what it's like being out there in the environment and having to go hunting earlier than normal and just how that's affecting people across the country.
Yeah, well, Alaska is warming 2 times faster than the lower 48. And so we're kind of the canary in the coal mine, as an old adage, right? Like hey, it's here, it's happening, it's fast. You know, Yari's talking about the sea ice being further out. And our season is extended almost 2 months. You know, the sea ice is open longer later in the season, opening up earlier in the season. And what we're having here is, you know, we had 30 days without rain, and that's going to cause more and more fires of the boreal forest. I remember elders talking about this 20 years ago about how it was starting to get warmer, and then we won't have black spruce because it'll be too warm and too dry for them because they need those bogs. And they're it's true. They're right. You know, the permafrost is melting, so we're losing that water that's locked up on land. All of those, you know, if you've ever seen a picture of the tundra, there's so much water. There's sloughs and bogs and lagoons and just so much water. And what's happening is the permafrost is melting, and so it's saturating into the ground and then flowing out to the ocean. And with our seasons changing, we have more precipitation. So we're getting more snow in the winter, more rain in the summer, but it's patchy. It's not like it used to be. I remember being a kid here, and it maybe 10 days of super sunny weather, and, you know, there's 9 months of winter. It'd freeze up in a couple of weeks. It'd be winter for 9 months, and, like, all of a sudden, in a matter of 3 weeks, everything would thaw. We call it break up, and then we'd have summer for 3 months. And now it's completely different. And our elders tell us that we're not going backwards, that Alaska's going to be warm again. And we have to adapt in a way that ensures food and security and medical for the people, but also supporting the animals so that they can transition as well. So when we start talking about just transition, we have to remember that's not just people, it's the environment that needs to transition with us.
And Yari, what are you hearing from the elders, like Mita's talking about you know, them seeing this and saying it's just moving forward?
I remember when I was 12 years old, my grandfather said it's a natural cycle. He said where it's hot, it's going to get cold. Where it's cold, it's going to get hot. We just have to learn how to adapt. He told me that long time ago. Stories passed down through generations. He's heard stories from his elders that at one point Alaska was hot. So it's a natural process.
And how are traditions incorporated into that traditional knowledge? How is that being used when it comes to addressing these types of things?
Sharing stories, passing down the stories through generations so that they know what to expect.
And that's a big part of how our traditional ecological knowledge and indigenous knowledge can help, not the only way, but one of the ways, is because America likes things to be stagnant or static, right? Reliable. There's the Gregorian calendar, the clock, and everything is supposed to just line up in all its little boxes and lines, where reality and natural law don't operate that way. And so by the knowledge that we're not going backwards, we have to adapt. Alaska's going to be warm again. You know, for some people, it's really scary. So it's like catching people before they go too far into that ecological grief or solastalgia and saying, we've done this before, right? We can do this again and start addressing. And that's part of why the decolonization is so important, is addressing our internal traumas and experiences, and not just Native people, but all of Americans. Because what happens is if those things are stuffed away, then people aren't able to transition well emotionally, right? And there's a failure to transition that happens. So addressing that spiritual health is one of the key components of us moving forward together and surviving this successfully.
And Yari, with your work, with what Mita is talking about, how important is it to help share the traditional knowledge without giving away? I mean, Indigenous people have knowledge that's sacred to them, that's not shared with others, but at the same time, there's traditional knowledge and stories that can be shared. And how can tribes and non-Native people work together to address some of these things?
Research, research, research. We need our own Indigenous researchers to work alongside with non-Native researchers. I always tell people, if you want to learn about a group of people, you have to expose yourself to them, not just sit there, interview them, and leave. You have to stay there for a certain amount of time to learn and understand. So I believe research is one of the first ways to do that.
And we're seeing that a lot of Indigenous, bringing in Indigenous people are needed in every walk of life to help and grow, and definitely the research as well.
Yeah, and that's part of the process, is because there's context or an indigenous lens. So I agree with Yari 100%. You have people who come in, they get information, and they leave, and they put it through the Western empirical data lens, and there's so much context that's lost, partially because in our traditional way, things aren't separate. You know, math and cosmology and physics and, you know, mental health, physical health, ecological health, they're all intertwined, and they all affect each other in very deep levels that don't fit in sound bites. They don't fit in the two-sentence documents, notes, right? And even if they did, if you're going to read it and decipher it, then you have to have that context of experience.
And how have you seen, you know, communities share this traditional knowledge with the pandemic? Because it has been rough for communities. Yari, go ahead.
I did a lot of storytelling via Zoom during the pandemic. I did a lot of work at home. I even did some storytelling on Zoom for children. I set that up on my own and invited some parents to join me to share traditional stories with small children. So I did a lot of speaking about Alaska Native traditions, cultures, traditional healing, and teach about wisdom, and it really helped a lot. But that physical connection, because in my culture, we love hugs. So it was very challenging to not be able to be in physical presence with others, but connecting on Zoom helped a lot.
And Mita?
Well, in the beginning of the pandemic, we have, you know, my fiance and I, we have 8 kids total. And so we had 7 in the house when it started. So it was really just making sure that we were set up to take care of the kids. And then once we had our rhythm down and we knew we were in for it for a while, then I started working with the Wilderness Society and started working on indigenizing conservation and bringing federal tribes and conservationists together is the work that I'm doing. And really getting to meet people all over the country working on the same things. It was kind of interesting because even though we were disconnected, there was a level of connectivity that happened that we didn't have before. And being able to get that information out and have that time with working together in those groups. And part of that work is to translate what does it mean, you know, traditional stewardship practices. What are these things? And so we've been really working on that. And actually, right after this, I go and present on Indigenous protocols to the executive team and get their feedback on that. So we're making advances.
And, you know, now that things are slowly opening up and there's more opportunities for people to get together in person, do you see that changing? Because there's definitely still knowledge being shared over the internet as well.
Yes, people are coming back together because we miss it. That's Yari said, we love, her community loves hugs, and most of our communities love hugs. Actually, last week was Celebration in Southeast Alaska, and it's a gathering of the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian peoples in Southeast. And it happens every 2 years, and we haven't had one in 4 years. And we went down. My fiance and I went down because for my birthday, he was like, "What do you want?" You know, and I said, "I want to go home. I want to see my people. I want to hug and dance and sing and laugh and, you know, just see them in person again for all of us who made it through." And Wrangell, actually, which is my home community, was able to do grand entrance and grand exit. And so that's what we did. We went and we sang and danced and drummed. And that was medicine, you know, getting to see them again. It healed so much grief and missing them for years now. And it only happens when you go and be with them.
And we definitely want to talk more about traditional healing. And that's part of it, is just being with each other and being with family. And we're here at the National Congress of American Indians mid-year event. We're going to take a quick break. Welcome back to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez from the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage, where the National Congress of American Indians mid-year event is taking place. We are with some great guests talking about traditional knowledge and how that's incorporated into not only the environment, but healing and healing the mind, body, and soul. So I'd like to welcome back our guests. Welcome Mita DeWitt and Yari Walker. Welcome back. And Yari, right before the break, Mita was talking about celebration and how that was healing. Talk and share a little bit about why traditions, when it's drumming, singing, dancing, how that is a healing, traditional healing for mind, body, soul.
A long time ago, my grandmother used to say, move, 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 move. And when you dance, you're moving around, it's healing for the physical body, for your emotion, your mental, and your spiritual. So dancing is a form of healing. It's a form of prayer. It's a form of storytelling and connecting with our ancestors in the form of entertainment. So it's a huge thing in our community. We get together and dance every weekend. In the summertime, sometimes they dance until 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And it's just a norm for us. And when I was taking my husband home, I told him, you know, this is normal for us. What's not normal for you is the normal for us. So be prepared to watch these kinds of things when you go home with me, because we're going to go until 2 in the morning.
And that's also a big part of, like, these gatherings here in Alaska and other gatherings I went to, is the music and sharing and dancing. And we know during the Alaska Federation of Natives that that's a big night, is if you don't get your tickets for the music and dance night, then you're out of luck. Mita?
Yeah, well, it's part of, you know, this synchronicity. So when we're drumming, you know, that beat together, we're working together as a community, it helps to strengthen those social structures. It also helps to move that energy through the body and open up any blockages that we might have, you know, whether they're physical blockages like tight muscles, or whether they're spiritual blockages or emotional blockages, because people actually hold memory in the body. And science is starting to catch up with our traditional ways of knowing. And they're saying, oh, there's, you know, the psychosomatic connection. And so when you're moving and moving that energy and singing, and there's the vibrations, and then also the humors of the body with the lymph, and everything is good circulation, right? And it gets moving. And I was just on break telling Yari, I was just about to tell her, I've had some trouble with one of my feet. I had plantar was it fasciitis or something? And so by the third day, my feet were sore because we were walking around Juneau, and I danced 3 times that first day, and we did the parade, and it was a grand exit. And I was telling my sweetheart, I was like, oh man, my feet hurt so bad. I don't know if I can do this. And I said, but I have to go talk to my aunties and let them know why I'm not walking in with them. And I walked over there, I was standing there, and literally my feet stopped hurting. And I was like, what? And so I texted him. I was like, I'm going to go dance. And so we get out there, and grand exit is when all the dance groups come through. So it's you're in it for a long haul, right? And so we're out there dancing, and I was like, I'm just going to keep going until, like, they give out, right? Hour and 15 minutes, and they were still fine. And I was like, this is miracle level, like no pain, like no issues, no tightness, nothing. It's just so powerful, that energy, when you're with your people and experiencing that, and you start to harmonize with them and get in sync, and then you're a greater part of a whole than just yourself.
And that's something to think about too, that Yari, when you're talking about the traditional healing and the spiritual aspect of it, and you know, when you go to the clinic, what's the first thing they do is write you a prescription. So go ahead, Yari.
I, when I feel sick or when I feel pain, I don't go to the hospital, because I practice traditional healing and my body knows, instinctively knows what's good for me. I learn from my ancestors. I learn from spirit helpers. I learn from Creator. My intuition tells me what's good for me, or they communicate with me and teach me what's good for me. So, for instance, one thing my ancestors taught me was, they told me, you are to gather rihlu, which is stinkweed or wormwood in English. Make it into a bundle and put it over your office door. They taught me that if I have rihlu above my office door, it wards away any bad energies or bad spirits and keep them away from my space. I do a lot of cleansing and meditation and prayer in that office space. And when I speak to Creator, I say, please remove anything unwanted from here. And when people walk into the space, allow them to feel healing, love, and all the good things from you. And when people come to my office, they always tell me that this space feels amazing. Sometimes I don't tell them what I practice there, and sometimes I just, you know, go with it. And I just love taking care of the space. And Creator spoke to me and said, you are to start meditating and praying at the Alaska Native Heritage Center because we are going to clean up that place together. So that's why I started doing it at the Heritage Center instead of just at home.
And how can people start their own healing process? If there's some people listening today and they're interested, but they don't know what to do, where to begin, what do you usually tell people? I mean, there's a lot of sessions even here at the National Congress where mental health is being looked at and different levels of even just policy levels as well as trying to address and getting tribes to look more at helping address that, because that's definitely a need in Indian country. I mean, we already have a long list across Indian country and here in Alaska, and healthcare is on top of a lot of people's agendas, but also mental health, which is lacking across the country and tribal communities. Yari?
People need to realize everything is aligned. Your entire being has to be aligned in order for us to be healthy. Your physical, your emotional, mental, and your spiritual. When people talk about mental, you also need to take care of the rest of your being. It has to be aligned. Once your entire being is aligned, you are a lot healthier than when you only focus on your physical and your mental. So you have to focus on your entire being instead of just part of, because that's what the Western culture focuses on, is the mental and the physical. When my son fell off a cliff in 2015, 180 feet when he was medevac, they only focused on his physical being. And when I was with him in the hospital, I immediately felt his depression and his stresses and his worries, because the man constantly does for others, and that's what he was already worrying about. And Mita helped. I contacted Mita because I was so desperate to help my son. And she brought to us a jar of rihluk, or stinkweed wormwood salve, that we used on my son. And my son reported to us that he preferred to use that over narcotics because it does the pain management better. He told us that he was pain-free for about 11 hours a day. And when we were doing that, when we were using the stinkweed salve on him, the nurse asked us what we were using, and I told her what it was, and she said, I didn't hear that and I didn't see that. You know, it does a job better than narcotics.
And Mita, maybe you can elaborate and explain how both the Western medicine and healthcare is combined together often when you do need that emergency, you know, visit, but also using traditional medicine and knowledge passed on?
Ooh, good question. And thank you, Yari, for that story. And thank you for honoring me and mentioning that salve. So it's kind of interesting because the Western medicine and traditional medicine, people like to think of them as something separate. However, traditionally, our medicine people would uptake knowledge and tools and information of the highest and best that they could find. And it was a knowledge exchange, like information was a currency amongst our medicine people. Because if you could figure out a better way to do it, then you're going to serve your people better. And it's a benefit to everybody. So Western medicine, you know, has its own issues. It's still very young. And there's an arrogance thinking that it's superior to traditional medicine. But once you're working with doctors who get past that, right, who can acknowledge that there's benefits in both sides, that's when you get to the, you know, the pinnacle that we could ask for, is when you start integrating Western medicine knowledge and traditional medicine knowledge, because you're going to be addressing the whole being. You know, and as Yari said earlier, it has to be in alignment. And our mental health issues in America and Indian country, you know, like if you just go to what's the basics, Vivian Mork always talks about being a biological being and needing water, air, nutrition, sleep, exercise, right? And if those are available and we create the spaces for those to be available, that's going to address a significant portion of the issues. And our traditional leaders, that was what they had to do, our leaders of the community, make sure that those foundational needs were met. Then, at that point, you started going to the elders for help, for their guidance and stories on how to balance your life. And everybody practiced plant medicine in the home. Everybody had healing hands in the home and gentle massage touch in the home. Our aunties and grandmas and even grandpas would provide those. And then if the elders, you know, like if they couldn't address it through those means, then you would go over to the specialist, the herbalist or the bone setter or the spiritual doctor, and they would help to find out what was out of balance to fix those things. And a lot of times it does come, you know, like either there's something that happened in a transgression in your lineage or past lineage and epigenetics that start to come up. We have these epigenetic memories that bubble up. And if you don't know the story of where it came from, it could look like an anomaly. But according to our traditional knowledge, our historical traumas and the experiences that our elders and ancestors have had, they start manifesting in our physical body. And when you start looking at mental health and epigenetics, it actually substantiates what our elders have told us. And then you have to look at long-term remediation or addressing the body and teaching the body how to be in alignment again. And part of the issue is we expect people have this expectation of going back to what they were or who they were in the past. But when we're healing, there's growth that happens, a maturation that happens. And the expectation, it's like a rites of passage when you go through your healing, and you will not be the same person on the other side. And it's okay. And not only is it okay, it's good, right? Because it has that growth.
And thinking about the historical trauma and looking about those, when you're talking about bubbling up, coming up, there are tough conversations that take place at this conference and other conferences as well, at AFN and Elders and Youth. There's a boarding school session here where that's a lot of historical trauma for people across Alaska and tribes in the lower 48, and talking about and sharing in a way that is healing. Yari?
I had to first recognize that I was a part of that historical trauma. I didn't know anything about residential schools. I did not know that both of my parents went to boarding schools. My father went to Wrangell Institute in the 1940s, and my mother went to the lower 48. And growing up, I had a very abusive mother, and I didn't understand why she didn't show compassion towards me and my siblings, but showed that to her nieces and nephews. I used to be very jealous of my cousins because we didn't get the same. And when I moved here in 1997, that was the first time I ever heard about boarding schools. I was in shock and said, wow, now I understand why my mom was the way she was. So my mom is currently still on a healing journey, and I want to be on that journey with her together, not just me, not just her, but all of us together as a family. I think it's important for us to talk about it and to admit, yes, it's there, because, you know, we all need healing from it, both natives and non-natives. We all need healing. And going back to what Maida said, one of my dreams and hopes is for traditional healers to work alongside with Western medicine, counselors, doctors, to work with these jails and universities. I think we need our traditional people to work alongside with all these entities and organizations, integrate our traditional knowledge into the system to help better our community, I think.
And Mita, go ahead.
Oh, I was just listening in agreement and thinking about, I was in that space of imagining what our healthcare would look like, our communities look like when we get to that point of integration and working together with respect with each other and our traditional knowledge, which is science. It's real science, hard science. And once those become integrated practice, then, you know, the world's not going to be perfect because we're human, right? So there's no perfect healing isn't an end goal. It's a process that we continually go through. And so thinking about it in that way, you know, that acknowledgement of traditional healing and what it has to offer, I heard from Chris Cavlin, who has a PhD. He is in Australia, and he was talking about how 70% of our prescriptions are based on indigenous plant knowledge, 70%, but it's not acknowledged, you know, publicly, that, and there's no reciprocity for that that occurs. And there's so much that indigenous people have already contributed. Look at our world food systems with the corn and potatoes and squash, and that process of companion harvesting and permaculture is based and rooted in indigenous knowledge and philosophy. And so, you know, American Sign Language was a Plains trade language originally. The kayak, every outdoors person is kayaked. That comes from our Inuit peoples. So that acknowledgement of what's already been contributed, bringing in those researchers to help create that indigenous lens and context, and then that working together in co-collaboration. And if we can manage that, then we truly can have the best world in existence that we could imagine.
And I think also going along with that is there's definitely a need for resources. We're hearing from tribal leaders that are here that all of these things that we're talking about, is there's a need for resources, and how and where are those resources going to come from? Our producer, Emily Schwing, got a chance to talk to Mike Williams Sr., who's a known tribal leader here in Alaska, and his thoughts on resource needs.
I'm a behavioral health retired counselor. So I'm I've been involved with mental health and substance abuse issues for a long time as a counselor, working to help revive the traditional counseling methods, the issues of how to raise our children and how we dealt with these underlying cause for misery. So I was able to converse or to gather some elders from our region to have this traditional healing methods, physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional health to be addressed. So we have those cataloged, and I think that's one of the most important ways of dealing with these behavioral health, suicide, and domestic violence issues, and they've been very helpful. And we're just beginning it, but we need more resources to accomplish those in our community. So I think that's just a start.
And that was Mike Williams Sr. talking about the need for resources when talking, and he was talking about the traditional healing aspect as well. Yari, how can resources help improve a lot of these issues we're talking about?
Well, like I said earlier, relationships first. Build a relationship with Indigenous serving entities, organizations, programs, and work alongside with them. And just get to know each other and work together in unity and collaborate. I think that's where we need to start.
And Mita?
Well, the reality is at this point in time, we live in a cash economy. And one of the challenges that I've seen in the past is people will ask from elders to come and share or to do things, and then they gift them in a traditional way, which is appropriate. However, you know, there's I've seen elders who might have a whole closet full of blankets and pouches of tobacco and other gifts, but they can't pay for their electricity or for their cell phone or get their base needs met. So the resources is something that we do have to address head on, and we have to acknowledge that there's a reciprocity that needs to occur, and that reciprocity today does happen in a cash, you know, or currency exchange. But traditionally, you know, if we put it through that framework, then the issue, you know, like our medicine people, you would gift them with the value of what they did for you or what you're asking from them. The medicine person didn't have to name their price and should never have had to name a price and don't anticipate receiving anything. So it can't be done in greed or expectation. The gift is given, and then the reciprocal gift is given. And in today's day and age, that's money, right? And so then the person who's providing the healing can buy groceries or, you know, get medicine for their kids or clothes for their, you know, shoes for their kids or pay their phone bill, electric bill, pay their mortgage, and live in a way that has that base needs met, that base security that's met. Because people can't constantly be giving of themselves and have their base needs unmet, because what happens is it creates a polarity switch or a vacuum of where we're taking from them, which is bad. It's not good. It's a bad way of doing things. So that is important to have that foundational, you know, support of these programs and not make medicine people have to beg or take on two or three jobs to do the work.
And there's also a lot of educating that goes into all of this when we're thinking about the resources. And there's a lot of red tape, and tribes go through these grant processes. And it's a lot of education about, you know, Native people and the way tribal communities work and how everything is supposed to work together. And so there is definitely that resources need that people are talking about here at NCAI. And also there's a lot of youth. There's a youth track here. There's a focus on young people. So how can young people get involved? And, you know, I know that during Elders and Youth Conference that takes place in Alaska, elders and youth are working side by side for a week and learning from one another, and that knowledge is passed on with each other. So how can that happen outside of a conference, whether outside of NCAI, outside in the communities? How can that happen, Yari?
I always encourage youth to seek out guidance and wisdom from our elders. It's so important to learn from them because they have more experience, patience, and knowledge, wisdom, more than we do. So it's so important for us to reach out to the elders, but also give them the opportunity to do that. The Qazghiq that I mentioned earlier, the functional Qazghiq, is a perfect example for youth and elders to come together where the youth can learn from the elders. I'm also interested in seeing a not just an elders program, but a youth and elders program in the community, in our communities, not just in one community, but it would be amazing to see that all across the country and here in Alaska too, because once our elders pass away, they're going to take that knowledge with them. So it's really important for us to sit down with them and give them the opportunity to teach us. There was an elder who used to live upstairs from me. I used to hear him kind of angry, and, you know, and one day I decided, I'm going to go visit him. So I went upstairs with some traditional foods and knocked on the door and offered him food, and I asked him, can I please visit with you for a while? He said, sure. I sat with him, and as soon as I sat with him, he began to share stories with me about a long time ago, and he began to cry. And I asked him, would you mind sharing with me why you're crying? He said, this is the first time I'm given the opportunity to share about my stories and about a long time ago, and it feels really good, and it's healing for me. And I sat there and cried with him and just listened to his stories. Our elders long to share their stories, and growing up, and even in my adult years, I used to sit next to my grandma and just sit there quietly, because I knew if I did that, She would start to share stories with me.
And that's so beautiful. I was lucky enough to have my grandmother to live to the age of 99. And I miss her so much, but definitely thinking about our elders. And Mita, how can youth get interested in environmental issues and using traditional knowledge? It seems like technology, everybody has their cell phones and are paying attention on their cell phones. So how can young people get involved?
Well, man, there's so much energy with our younger generations, and they already are aware. I mean, we look to traditionally our young people to troubleshoot our system processes, and they find the areas that are hypocritical. They find the areas that are out of balance really easy. If you've ever spent time with teenagers, you'll know they'll find the weak points. And so that interface between elders and youth is so critical, because elders can give that wisdom and perspective, and then youth can troubleshoot the system and call out the hypocrisy. And that's what's happening right now with climate change. They know what's happening, and they are telling the adults, wake up, it's time. So that's the big push is, okay, they want information, they want knowledge, and it's up to us to share what we can with them and empower them to address this, because it's the world that they're inheriting and they're going to be responsible for. So youth, if you're listening, do everything you can to learn the stories and the traditional ecological knowledge and apply that to the system, so that way you ensure a long life on a healthy planet.
And that's a beautiful way to end and bring us to our hour, but also Yari wanted to give you your thoughts as well.
And youth, we also need our own policymakers and lawmakers so we can start changing the system. Not changing, but integrating our traditional knowledge into the system.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us and sharing your thoughts and your words. Thank you to our guests, our producer, Emily Schwing, and KMBA. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska's Native Voice is produced and directed, and it's a production of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. And this show was supported by the Climate Justice Resilience Fund. Join us again.